Actually, I should say good afternoon. Okay, good afternoon. And welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, the chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Misha Glenny. Misha Glenny is a distinguished journalist and historian. As a Central Europe correspondent, first for The Guardian and then for the BBC, he chronicled the collapse of communism and the wars in the former Yugoslavia. He has won several major awards for his work, including the Sony Gold Award for outstanding contribution to broadcasting. Misha is the author of three books on Eastern Europe and the Balkans, including The Rebirth of History, The Fall of Yugoslavia, and the Balkans. He is also the author of McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld. Misha has been regularly consulted by the U.S. and European governments on major policy issues, and ran an NGO for 3 years, assisting with the reconstruction of Serbia, Macedonia, and Kosovo. Misha is a former fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars in Washington, D.C., and a visiting professor at the London School of Economics. He lives in London. Misha's presentation today is based on his new book on cybercrime. Please join me in welcoming Misha Glenny.
I think I might take my jacket off because it's quite hot up here. Excuse me, I'm being a little informal, but appropriate really for the subject. So, it's dark market. I'm not going to tell you about dark market as such. Dark Market was a website, www.darkmarket.com, and the book is all about what went on in that website from 2005 to 2008. It was the premier English language criminal website in the world before it was brought down in late 2008. And the book is the story because it was administered by five so-called administrators, and it was a sort of supermarket for criminals on the web. So if you were a member of Dark Market, you logged in just as if you were logging into a forum discussing parenting or beekeeping or something like that, except on this one, when you logged in, having been vetted as a member, you would then go to a forum where you could buy or sell stolen credit card details in their tens of thousands, where you could buy and sell computer viruses and other types of malware. You could download all sorts of things, including tutorials on how to commit the latest cybercrimes and stuff like that. And then there was information about whether there were any bad criminals on the web, so-called rippers, who were ripping off other criminals, who were regarded the lowest of the low by decent, hard-working criminals. And but the thing about Dark Market is that it had five administrators who ran it, and one of them, it turned out, was an undercover agent of the FBI. And so the book is really a sort of, it's astonishing, it's all true, I didn't make it up, because I went and interviewed all the policemen involved, and then I tracked down all the criminals involved as well, and I interviewed them too, some in jail, some outside of jail, who are still active criminals, and still keep me in touch with what the latest stuff is on the web. So it's a rip-roaring read, written like a thriller, and well, obviously, I mean, I would say so, but it's well worth it. So I'm not going to tell you about that now, but there were so many issues that came up as I was researching this that I wanted to give you a sort of more broader background about what's going on the dark side, as it were, of the of the internet. So first of all, I want to tell you about the threats, what we've actually got going on out there. And in order to understand this a little better, I feel as though we have to divide it into three pillars. I call it the three pillars of malfeasance on the internet. So the first pillar is cybercrime. This is run-of-the-mill stuff, of which the most obvious one is credit and debit card fraud, which, according to Interpol, 65% of those of us standing here in this room or sitting in this room have been victims at one time or another. I know I have. In fact, I was a victim of it while I was researching this book. My card was skimmed, as we say, just after I'd finished having a meeting with big expert who was a criminal hacker involved in scamming poker sites, online poker sites, and he told me all the tricks about how they make money out of that. Just, this is totally in parentheses, but don't ever go to those poker sites which you have to pay for money. I know it's illegal in the United States, but it's all criminal scams, those things. But that's by the way. So we have cybercrime, you have the debit and credit card fraud, but you get lots of other ones as well. Things like the pump and dump scheme, where people actually go into stock market operations and electronically they raise the value of stock of a particular company, having bought money in that stock first of all, and when they've raised it as far as they think it can credibly go, they sell their stock and then they just forget about it and the stock collapses and they've made money. So that's very clever of them. So that's the first one, cybercrime. The second one is cyber industrial espionage. Now this is fundamentally the private sector and the threats faced by private sector, which is enormous. And the first one is the industrial espionage, which is of course people hacking into rival computers, the computers of rival companies, and just fishing around in their database and seeing what their product development is and what their marketing strategies are. I'm having to compete with the president here, so please bear with me. And it's just, you know, run-of-the-mill traditional industrial espionage, except it's done on a massive scale. And with China being such a prominent player in the cyber world, they do this thing on steroids, basically. They just go into as many computer systems as they can and rip it off. So there are lots of threats faced by companies, which one or two we'll see about later on. And then the third pillar is the big one. It's the mother of all pillars on cyber, which is cyber security and cyber warfare. This is the one where we're talking about the kind of apocalyptic stuff that can happen to our societies if our critical national infrastructure, as they call it, by which, of course, I mean the sort of power system, the telecoms, utilities, financial institutions, all these massive infrastructural operations are utterly dependent on networked computer systems. So if something went wrong with those networked computer systems, then very quickly we could be in a rather dire state. In fact, one of the main theorists of the attacks on critical national infrastructure, a man with the unlikely name of Scott Borg, says that it will take about 10 days for us to be reduced to the Stone Age if there was a serious coordinated attack on the critical national infrastructure. Anyway, so that's that. That's crime. And then I also want to tell you about the sort of people who are involved in malfeasance on the web. And there's a specific reason for this, because although it's very convenient for us to understand all the bad stuff that's going on in the net by looking at those three pillars, there are two human agencies which migrate between the three pillars all the time. And the most important one are these, the hackers. Because you cannot have a major attack on cyber without at some point the skills of an advanced computer user being involved. And most of them spend a lot of their time just doing ordinary run-of-the-mill cybercrime work. But they will often be employed either by companies or indeed coerced, as happens with states, into using their skills for bigger projects, be it industrial espionage or be it actually assisting a country in its national security objectives by hacking into other countries' computers, or as happened in 2007 and 2008 when massive attacks on the computer networks of Estonia and Georgia were coordinated from Russia, from the Russian Federation, with the assistance of the run-of-the-mill criminal hackers, and we'll talk about that a little earlier, a little later on. The other human agency who migrates between the three pillars, interestingly enough, are the intelligence agencies, because they need to know whether a criminal website like Dark Market, for example, is being used by an insurgent or terrorist operation to raise revenue. And so they will sniff around and see what's happening all over the place as well. And it was amazing when I was researching Dark Market how often I would suddenly bump into, sort of digitally as it were, an agent of Turkish domestic intelligence or the KGB or the CIA, whoever it was. Finally, I'm just going to give you a few hints as we go along, although this is usually better done at the end with questions, about what we can do about all this stuff that's going on the net, and if there's any way that we can protect ourselves both individually and in terms of society. So we're going to start off with cyber threat, and I want to give you a sense of some of the other crimes beyond the credit card threat that exist out there. Now, about a month ago, the White House came out with a figure of how much damage is inflicted on the global economy every year through malfeasance on the web. And they said it is costing us $1 trillion a year. Now, if you take the figure that $65 trillion is global GDP, that's an absolutely massive amount that cyber malfeasance accounts for. But, of course, it's a fictional number. We have absolutely no idea how much cyber crime and other forms of malfeasance, how much damage it inflicts on us, because very many victims of cyber crime or cyber industrial espionage, they don't report it. They don't report it either because they don't know, or because when they ring up the police don't know what they're talking about. Or if you're a company, the last thing you want to say is I've had a major breach of my data banks. And that way is the fastest way to a collapse of your stock. And so there is no mandatory reporting system anywhere in the world about breaches. And this is a big problem because it means we don't know what the extent of the problem is. And if you don't have a measurement of the problem, you cannot create a secondary insurance market so that risk can be calculated and businesses can insure themselves against the problems going on. And until we find a way of making sure that data breaches are reported without people being too frightened to do it, perhaps anonymously, then it's going to be very, very difficult to understand what's going on. Some of the crimes are absolutely fantastic. So let's take the first 6 months of 2010. Now, you may or may not know, but in 2010, $17.5 million were stolen in conventional armed bank robberies around the United States. $17.5 million, quite a lot. And, of course, whenever you have a bank robbery with people going in with guns and stuff like that, the media just goes berserk. They come out of the bank with their swag over their backs and shooting and things like that, and the cops are there, and then out come the media helicopters, and they chase them down the freeway, and everyone's watching, and they say, oh, my God, this is so exciting and so terrible. Now, at the same period, for the first 6 months of 2010, there was a little group of people in Ukraine who were perpetrating another type of fraud. Now, what they did, this was called a payroll scam. They broke in to the data, network computer systems of a major West Coast corporation, a very big one. They got through the digital wall, and they found the human resources and the accounting departments in the computers, and they set up several dozen phantom employees. And these phantom employees, of course, had to be paid every month. And they were paid something in the region of $10,000 every month. And they were paid out, this money was paid out to money mules all over the United States. Now, you may or may not know what money mules are, but if you're ever sitting on the computer and you see an ad on the browser saying, you know, make money at home by sitting at your computer by doing bugger all and make lots of money, press on this link. And what will happen is you will get someone saying, hey, great that you want to work with us. This is what you have to do. Put your bank account at our disposal. Every month, $10,000 will come in. You can keep $1,000 of those $10,000 and send $9,000 to us at this bank in Latvia, which is where this actually happened in the case of this West Coast corporation. It was then also transferred later on to Ukraine as well. So over the six-month period that this scam was going on, this one Ukrainian group made $40 million, which is over twice as much as all the money made out of conventional armed bank robberies in the United States during the same period. And was there any media coverage of it? Of course not, because there weren't any cops and robbers chasing through the streets of Los Angeles or wherever it was. So, what does that mean? It means that you have low risk and high returns if you're involved in cybercrime, which is why we're beginning to see traditional organized criminal groups migrate over to cyber, because they don't have to risk violence. Cybercrime is really unique for organized crime because you don't need to deploy violence to be successful at it, which is a very interesting thing. But I want to introduce you to the wonderful world of scareware. Yes, this is the world of a group known as Innovative Marketing. Now, most of the people involved in the Kiev headquarters, we're back in Ukraine again, I'll explain why Ukraine is so popular a little later on, of Innovative Marketing. They were young kids. They thought that they were engaged in a fabulous sort of startup, you know, cutting-edge company developing software for people all over the world. And they didn't know that they were involved in one of the biggest ever financial frauds over the web. And incidentally, although they were all Ukrainians, the ones working in Kiev, the guys who ran this company and set it up were Swedish and Indian, which testifies to the fact that cybercrime, although it was incubated in places like Brazil, Russia, India, and China, the fabled BRIC countries, as a Goldman Sachs economist named them, it has now spread all over the world. Anyway, what Innovative Marketing did was they sent out malware around the world through the internet, and this would lead to a pop-up on your browser, and the pop-up would say, your computer is infected with the most terrible viruses ever known to mankind, and you're going to die, but help is at hand because Innovative Marketing has the solution. And all you have to do is download our antivirus software and pay for it, and then everything will be fine. So here's one of their standard operations, Malware Destructor 2009, powerful and efficient internet antivirus suite, which promises you all sorts of protection against the nasty stuff on the web. And if you see down in the bottom right-hand corner there, it is endorsed by CNET, PC Pro, all the big online tech mags. Now, how many people actually ever go to CNET and PC Pro to see what the Malware Destructor 2009 really scored on their tests? Of course, they weren't tested. They weren't tested at all. And it doesn't matter if a few people actually do that, because there are so many suckers out in the world that the great majority are not going to bother. But they didn't restrict themselves to antivirus suites. They had other software on offer. Here's one of my favorites, Ecology Green PC, which promises to reduce your CO2 emissions from your competing work by up to 80%. I think that's marvelous, and I'm sure here, particularly on the West Coast, people would have loved this software if they could have got hold of it, and they would have only paid $49.95 for a year's eco-computing, or for those of you with a real conscience, a lifetime of eco-computing for $79.95. And lots of people, of course, did. Now, the only drawback about Ecology Green PC and Malware Destructor 2009 is that in order to install it, you were requested to uninstall your existing antivirus stuff, like Norton and McAfee and all that sort of thing. And so dutifully, of course, those people who were concerned that their computers were riddled with these awful viruses, uninstall their antivirus protectors, actually leaving themselves open to really the very nasty stuff on the web. And of course, the irony of all this is that you are paying for the privilege of screwing up your computer. Now, amazingly, for a group of hackers, these guys left the port open, one of the ports open on their main server, which was located in Malaysia. And a friend of mine, who's a bit of a hacker, managed to get into that port, look at their server, and he downloaded everything they had on their servers, including all their invoices over a 3-year period. And because he's a bit anally retentive, he examined the whole thing and calculated that over a 3-year period, they had invoiced for and received payments to the value of $500 million from people around the world. So successful was this company. Let's have a little closer look at that bill. Look, they've got call centers. Yes, they were doing so well that they've got help centers. That's absolutely amazing. They had a German language help center in Poland, a French language help center in Algeria, and of course the English language help center was naturally in India.
Welcome to customer support service.
Thank you for calling customer support. This is Mike. How can I help you?
Yes, hello. My name is Todd Marble. I called about 10 minutes ago because I had purchased your Virus Remover 2008 program, and I'm still having trouble getting it onto my PC.
Could I have your order number, sir?
Yes, I can give that to you. Are you ready?
Now, Mike, our man in Hyderabad, is asking Todd Marvel for his order number because he needs to know which particular fake product he's pretending to assist with. 20 minutes after poor Todd first rang, he is at the end of his tether.
You're not listening. You're not listening to me. I'm trying to shut my computer down because I cannot go anywhere. It's locked up on me. So I'm going to pull the plug on it and shut it down.
No, sir. Kindly listen to me. So what I suggest you is, you please restart your computer in the safe mode with networking, sir.
To be honest with you, I am not a computer literate type of guy. I don't know how to shut it down in safe mode.
Well, in that case, what I suggest is you just contact your system vendor, sir. They might help you out with it, okay?
Yes, so that was poor Todd Marvel. He had to contact his system vendor after 20 minutes of talking to Mike in Hyderabad, and he didn't yet know that his computer was riddled with all manner of viruses and was essentially a write-off. But those sorts of things, you know, they're a pain, they're difficult, they're damaging for the individuals involved, but they're not really catastrophic. And this is what most of cybercrime is about. It's about real inconvenience for people involved. But there are some people, when you get into deeper types of identity threat, where it can be really distressing. And here's a man who knows all about it. This is a guy called Roger Mildenhall, who was an Australian who moved to South Africa for work. And back in Perth, he had to purchase 2 houses, which were effectively his pension plan. And there he was working away in South Africa, having a good time. And one day he got a phone call from one of his neighbors in Perth. And the neighbor said, Roger, I can understand why you sold the first house, but why have you put the second house on the market as well? And Roger Mildenhall said, what are you talking about?
Well, I thought I was having my leg pulled, and I'm sure that they were having a fun at me, but it turned out that it was all true.
Scammers posing as Mr. Mildenhall had told his real estate agent he wanted to sell, even producing duplicates of the deeds to the house. He rushed back to Perth to find a second property he owned was also about to be sold and convinced the agent to cancel that sale.
Now, that first house had been sold for $350,000 Australian dollars. And the way that it was done is that the Nigerian scammers had broken in to his yahoo.com email account, and they had gone through the whole thing, and they had found the title deeds to the properties. And once they'd done that, they got in touch with this real estate agent and instructed them to sell the house, and the house was sold, and the proceeds from that house were sent to a bank in China from where the money was laundered. And I detail that for you because I just want to point out, I have to ask a rhetorical question here, which law enforcement agency is responsible for that investigation? Is it the Nigerians, where the scammers actually were? Is it the South Africans, where Mr. Mildenhall is? Is it the Americans, because .com is under US jurisdiction? Is it the Australians, obviously, where the houses are and where the crime took place, as it were? Or is it the Chinese, where the money was actually laundered? And the answer, of course, is that nobody will investigate it because it's simply too complicated, and relations between all those various police forces make it too difficult to mount a coherent investigation. Now, the question is, though, is there's one thing missing on this, because there's been some rather silly behaviour in all of this from the real estate agent.
Everything that they'd heard seemed plausible, but they saw me and said, oh yes, that is you, and then I showed them all my signatures, passport, driver's license, whatever, and we looked at the offer and acceptance and they said, but that's not your signature. And I said, that's what I've been trying to tell you all along.
Yes, the real estate agent, like everyone here, is they're so used to getting documents and all this sort of stuff over the internet that they've forgotten about the basics. Is it this guy's signature? And that's because we as a race, we love convenience. We love getting the latest gadgets. We love not having to bother with things. And that is beginning to change our behavior fundamentally. We're becoming very lax and very sloppy. And often we don't understand what the implications are. And this is an important point because most of cybercrime is perpetrated not because of people having really brilliant digital skills, but through a different set of skills which are known as social engineering. Social engineering is a very important thing. It's the art of persuading somebody to do something like click on a link which is objectively not in their interests. Now, I expect you all remember from the olden days of the 1990s that one of the most successful viruses that ever ran around the web was the I love you virus. You know, so you get a thing in your email saying, I love you. And look, we're all human. Who can resist it? We all want to be loved by people, don't we? And so we see I love you and we say, who is it? Who loves me? Who loves me? And now, I was very fortunate about this because the first person I received the I love you virus from was my ex-wife. And she harbored all sorts of any manner of emotions towards me, but love was not amongst them. And so as soon as I saw this I love you from my ex-wife, I said, well, that can't be true. And so I immediately I put it away in the trash can and saved myself a very nasty infection. So you must be extremely careful because social engineers are out to get you all the time. And I want to show you a little German film here which perhaps explains some of the gullibility and fallibility that has started to appear in our behavior.
Schmidt, Peters, Jansen, Hermans. Is your son home?
Yes, he's up in his room. Come in.
Hi, is Klausy here?
Yeah, upstairs.
Well then, we'll go up and try out some kinky stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Cool location.
Where is Klaus?
There.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Is this little Anna? You've got a nice bunny. Come on, I'll show you a real bunny.
In real life, you would protect your children. So why not protect them on the internet?
Yep, and the reason why, I mean, it's a very useful little film, that, and the reason why is precisely because of this business of the social engineers. Because people involved in malfeasance on the web are really, really smart people. They're very creative, and I have to say that on one level, they're great fun to hang out with, because that's one of the things I've been doing over the past 3 years. And they're so ahead of the curve. So this is what they were doing. I'm about to show you what they were doing 10 years ago, advertising what was a revolutionary website called Carter Planet. which was founded in 2001, and this was one of their first adverts. Now, Carter Planet, founded by a group of criminals in Odessa in 2001, was the first of the Superstore forums of criminals, and it was very successful indeed. And the reason why it was successful is that one of the challenges that it met was the greatest problem. It overcame the greatest problem facing the criminal on the internet. And that is, if you're a criminal doing business on the internet with another criminal, it's axiomatic, because they're a criminal, that they're untrustworthy. So how do you get over that problem of the untrustworthiness of your interlocutor? Well, Carter Planet did it. This is what, when you signed into Carter Planet, this is what you see. I told you it was like one of these forums, so you can go and do all of that stuff there. They did it by creating what was called the escrow office. And the escrow office was run by one of the five administrators, administrators of Carter Planet. And they would, so if you're selling, say, 10,000, which is a realistic figure, 10,000 stolen credit card details, and you had a purchaser, but, you know, you didn't know, could you trust them? And the purchaser didn't know if they could trust you. So you, as the vendor, you would send your 10,000 stolen credit card details to the escrow officer, and the purchaser would send the money digitally to the escrow officer. The escrow officer would then take a sample of the stolen credit card details at random and send them to his pals and minions all over the world, in Rio, in Toronto, in London, in Cape Town, doesn't matter. And they would go and try them in ATMs. And if they worked, they would keep the money, and the escrow officer would keep the money that they got out of those ATMs as a fee for the office. And the escrow officer would then release the credit card details to the purchaser and release the money to the vendor. And this revolutionized cybercrime on the internet, particularly the credit and debit card fraud. And the first decade of this century became just a sort of champagne party of what we call carding. Really, some astonishing things started to go on. Now, it then started spawning various sort of sub-businesses. And one of the most important sub-business was the sale of skimmers. Skimmers. So skimmers are the little lips that you slap onto an ATM so that when someone puts their card into the ATM, it's not only being read by the ATM, but it's being read by the skimmer as well. And that will then communicate the data to the criminal, who will be able to use that data to make a cloned credit card and then use that credit card wherever. And they also, the skimmers also come in the sort of point of sale, those things you get in restaurants and stuff. So they're actually made legally as well. But there were certain people who made a huge reputation and earned a lot of money by creating unlicensed skimmers. And I want to introduce you to probably the greatest skimmer seller in history. And, well, I'll let him introduce himself.
Hi, my name is Chao. I'm developer of skimming devices. I work for you 24 hours a day and make the best devices for skimming. You'll be able to make money in this business with me and my crew. A lot of people ask me how to choose the place to work with skimmer. Choosing the place to work is one of the most important things what you're gonna do. There are many nightclubs around. Go into the place, looking around to see what's going on. For example, we see ATM with many tourists, taking the statistics, taking the pictures of ATM and of what's around the place. Find a nightclub where young people are spending money of their parents. Try to not install on the mornings. People are vigilant at this time. Try not to work in places where 250 people a day are going through. Do not install in the districts with many illegal immigrants. So that's all about it.
Now, Chow sold his skimmers at $7,000 a pop from his factory in Istanbul, and he sold them all over the world, and he made millions and millions of dollars with this trade. And he was an interesting character, Chow, because he was atypical, I think, of many of the cyber criminals on the web. But that's not quite true. I wouldn't say he was atypical. I would say he belonged to what I call the third ring of cyber criminals. And those are people who not only have very advanced criminal skills, but they also have extremely advanced social engineering skills. And actually, I would describe their sort of socio-psychological personality as psychopathic. But I'll come to that in just a minute as I introduce you to a few of the guys who I've been meeting in recent years. This is Dmitry Golubov, a.k.a. Script, born in Odessa in 1982. He was the co-founder of Carta Planet, the original one that I showed you earlier on. Now, Dmitry grew up in the 1990s in the Black Sea port of Odessa in an atmosphere, a social and economic situation known as gangster capitalism, where basically everyone had to hustle, to thieve, to be a gangster in order to survive and to make money. But Dmitry was also very gifted at using computers, and what he did was to take the model of gangster capitalism from his hometown of Odessa and put it on the web. And this point in time, just after the millennium, was a time when banks really had no serious security operations in place, and also where companies who were first getting in to commerce on the internet had their databases of credit cards and all that sort of thing very, very openly exposed to the likes of Dmitry. Then we have Renukant Subramaniam, a.k.a. Jilzy, one of the founders of Dark Market. Now, Renu was brought up, he was in his, sort of 8, 9, 10, in the early 80s in Sri Lanka, in the capital, Colombo, and he was a Tamil from the Tamil minority. And this was at a time when the civil war broke out, and it was particularly dangerous to be a Tamil in Colombo at the time, as you had Sinhalese mobs roaming the place looking for Tamils to murder. So he then, with his parents, moved up to Jaffna, which was the stronghold of the Tamils up in the north. But then the civil war broke out there really ferociously, and he was almost caught in the crossfire a couple of times. He was moved back to Colombo, where the Sri Lankan army accused him as a 12-year-old of being a bomb maker for the Tamil Tigers, the main insurgent organization, which he wasn't. But his parents were very worried about his future, so they sent him to his aunt and uncle in England, where he eventually applied and received political asylum. But as a 13-year-old, he went to a very big, rough school in East London, where he was systematically bullied, and he withdrew back to his home. In fact, he eventually refused to go to school, and he sought solace in a world of television and a world of computers, because Renu was very gifted at one thing, and that was math. And he was soon finding his way very easily around the internet, and he loved this new environment, and it was the one place where he could make friends and that he wasn't being attacked either by Sinhalese rioters or indeed bullies at school. But he was very vulnerable as a character, and he was soon spotted by smarter people around the world, and being used, and he sunk into criminality. Then we have Matrix 001, who was born into a respectable middle-class family in southern Germany. Indeed, his mother worked as a clerk of the local court. Now, he was obsessed by games as a 13-year-old. But at the time, his family still had a pretty primitive computer set up, and he was cracking and pirating lots of games that were being made and distributed. And what he did was to look for servers all around the world, huge corporate servers, where he could store these games that he was pirating. And something's happened to my computer. How strange. Anyway, it's not the end of the world. he would do that, and as a consequence, he would start talking in hackers' forums and things like that, and various people spotted him, and they started to involve him incrementally into criminal activity when he was still 14, 15 years old. And that age thing is very important. Then, of course, we have Max Butler, born in Meridian, Idaho. Now, in the late 1990s, Max Butler was one of the best penetration testers working here out of Santa Clara, as it happens. A penetration tester is somebody who is paid by corporations to break in to their systems to see how well defended they are. And he was very highly respected, and he worked voluntarily for the FBI as well. But the problem for poor Max was basically he was a congenital hacker. And at one point he discovered in 1998 an extraordinary vulnerability that affected all U.S. government networks, including the nuclear research facilities at places like Livermore. Now, he was a good guy, Max, and he patched up all of these systems, saving the United States a major security embarrassment. But as I said, he was a congenital hacker, and what he did was he also put in a little wormhole through which he alone could wriggle, because that's what hackers do. And unfortunately, this was spotted by a U.S. Air Force investigator at the time. The U.S. Air Force had responsibility for cyber. And as a consequence of this, he ended up in an open prison in Taft, as it happens, for a couple of years. Now, it was an open prison, and so the other inmates of this prison were largely people involved in white-collar financial crime. And when Max Butler arrived on their doorstep, they couldn't believe their luck that here was a goose laying golden eggs, if only he could be taught how to do it. And when he got out of prison, of course, he couldn't find a job because he had a criminal record. Security people shunned him, and so on and so forth. He was in financial and social distress. And a couple of guys who he'd met at the Taft Correctional Institute came out, offered him an apartment, offered him a computer, offered him anything he want, and he reemerged as Iceman, one of the most successful criminal hackers in history, before he was eventually caught again in 2007. And this man with a planetary-sized brain is now serving a 13-year sentence in Lompoc. Then we have Adewale Taiwo. Now, Adewale, just before he moved to the United Kingdom in 2005, set up his rather prosaically named news group, bankfrauds@yahoo.co.uk, and then moved to the United Kingdom, carrying on this work, but was also doing a master's degree in chemical engineering at Manchester University, which he passed with flying colors, and then became one of the best chemical engineers, one of the best engineers developing chemical applications for the oil industry in an extremely successful small company in the United Kingdom. But he simultaneously ran a bank and credit card fraud, which was an international global operation worth millions. He was eventually arrested in March 2008. You can read about his story in Dark Market. It's very entertaining. And he was deported from Britain to Nigeria in April of this year. And then we have Chatai Evyapan. That is Chow, the animated figure you saw earlier on. And Chow had one of the finest digital protection networks of all cyber criminals, and he was eventually caught not because the FBI and the Turkish cyber police were able to penetrate his defenses, but because one of his minions slipped up and was spotted and was tailed in a much more conventional type of policing operation. So those are the sort of people who are out there. And I want to say something about the characteristics that these guys share. First of all, they all became involved in hacking when they were in their early teens. And what's important about this is they become hackers before, and even criminal hackers, before their moral compass has been properly developed. And that means that by the time they're beginning to understand that maybe some of the stuff that they're involved in is not such a good idea, they are too locked into that environment and they don't know how to get out of it. All of them showed advanced ability in math, physics, and or other sciences. Most of them, with the exception of Script and Chow, also had fairly serious social disabilities in terms of communicating with ordinary people in the outside world, i.e. they were moving close towards characteristics associated with Asperger syndrome along what we call the spectrum order. And I think it's very important to point out that Matrix, Max Butler, and Renucanth would not, I am convinced, have ever been involved in crime of any significant sort were it not for the internet. And that means we have to look at people involved in malfeasance on the web in a different way. And we have to find ways of engaging them. Now, at the moment, I'm just going to show you what's happening on the other side, and that is the amount of money we are spending and what we're doing in terms of protection of the internet. And what we find is that large sums of money, about $110 billion a year, are going into internet protection, over $10 billion of which in the last year were invested in this, United States Cyber Command, which is now the fifth military domain, joining land, sea, air, and space. And interestingly, it is the first ever man-made military domain, which is a really fascinating concept. In my opinion. It's run by a man named General Keith Alexander, who also, but not coincidentally, happens to run the NSA, the National Security Agency, which I'll talk about in a second. So there's a lot of money going in that. And, of course, there are a lot of companies which are interested in offering services to the U.S. Cyber Command, like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and these types of characters, because there is a huge amount of money to be made out of government procurement in cyber security these days. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, I'm six of one, half a dozen the other. And in many respects, it's a good thing. But out of that $110 billion a year, we are investing nothing in investigating, researching, trying to understand those people engaged in cyber malfeasance, like the guys I showed you earlier. And more than that, we do nothing about their rehabilitation once they have been convicted and put in prison. And it's my contention that what we're doing is we're driving these people who have real abilities back into crime and bad stuff. Then we have the cybercrime fighters, whose stories you can again read about in Dark Market. And the problems that they face are really quite severe, because those people involved in crime on the net, of course, and if we think of U.S. Cyber Command as being responsible for the military stuff, these are the people who are responsible, the FBI and so on, Secret Service, for the crimes against civilians and so on. If you're committing a cybercrime, you can be in Kazakhstan, you can decide to do it in Kazakhstan, commission it there, you can commit it against somebody who's in California, and you can cash out, you can get the money in somewhere like Dubai. I.e., for you, it's a borderless world that you're operating in. But for law enforcement, it is not a borderless world. They are restricted by their jurisdictions. Now, there are some ways that they can get around that. The United States, for example, decides that anywhere, any transaction, whether legal or illegal, that is dollar-denominated is immediately part of U.S. territory. So there are some ways of getting around it, but usually you have to cooperate with other police forces, and you may not have very good relations with them. So these are considerable problems, particularly since we have different legislation regarding the internet and internet crime in almost every territory around the world, and often reconciling those two, those various legislatory traditions is very difficult. And then we have the private sector, the industrial espionage and all that sort of stuff. Now, the private sector is responsible for protecting itself, but I think it's important to point out, if we look at some of the institutions and companies that have been hit over the past 2 years or so, and how much money they are in a position to lose. So, for example, Sony PlayStation lost $170 million to its bottom line because of the hack that happened earlier this year. We are now in a position where it is quite possible that a serious company could go under because of the consequences of a cyber attack. And as a consequence of that, Companies need to know about educating their workforce, educating themselves, and knowing that cybersecurity is not just about having a couple of guys in the basement who, whenever a computer goes wrong, tells you to turn it off and turn it on again. It's got to be structured right up the entire company, and it's got to be understood by board members as well. Unfortunately, most board members are usually over 55 years old, and they think this whole thing is nonsense, and so they don't bother about it. That has got to change, and far be it from me to quote my former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, but what we need for this is education, education, education. Then, of course, we have this little operation, the NSA, the National Security Agency, which together with its colleagues in the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia and New Zealand, is the most powerful spy agency in history. And most of its espionage work is using its digital capacity, which is absolutely vast. And they can look at things in a way that nobody else can, including decrypting a lot of encrypted material. So although we quite understandably bitch about the Russians and the Chinese being all over us all the time, don't forget that if you're an officer of the KGB or the People's Liberation Army responsible for cyber, you're looking at the NSA and all of its assets, and you're also looking at the two largest data depositories in the world, Google and Facebook, which, because they're registered, the parent companies are registered in the United States, an FBI or an NSA officer can have access to any Gmail account it wants with a court order within 24 hours, but even a friendly police force like the Serious Organized Crime Agency in London will require at least 6 months going through procedural issues before it can have access to a Gmail account involved in one of its investigations, by which time, of course, the bird has flown. And if you're that KGB or the PLA officer, you're never going to get to the Gmail account unless, of course, you hack it, which is what tends to happen. So there we are. So there are all sorts of now, all these agencies and all this law enforcement stuff, they're trying to accrue through legislation all the time greater, ever greater powers to be able to wander around the internet. And also they're trying to criminalize people who are doing things which they think is bad. There are very serious issues here relating to human rights, civil liberties, and the privacy of the individual, which we have to think very hard about before we hand out powers left, right, and center. And I want to end up by just looking at Stuxnet and what the Stuxnet virus means to the world. Now, Stuxnet is one of those viruses which, you know, threaten Armageddon, basically, or Cybergeddon, as they call it. And that's because Stuxnet, which was deployed quite specifically against two uranium enrichment facilities in Iran, is the kind of thing that can result in a catastrophe. It could have resulted in a nuclear meltdown had it not been spotted in time. It had already started functioning, and it had already started doing the bad stuff that it did, which is to interfere with the speed of the motor which ran the pumps pushing water around the two enrichment facilities in Iran. And had that not been spotted, you could have had a very, very serious accident. And the reason why Stux is so important is, first of all, we know from the way that it's built that it was built by a state. And that means we know that these weapons which do these terrible things are out there, but we also know that one state, it's contested which one it is, we can go into that afterwards if you like, but for the moment it's not important, but one state has said not only do we have this weaponry, but we are prepared to deploy it. And once Stuxnet was deployed, then everyone started accelerating the development of their cyber offensive weaponry. And this is a very, very dangerous world that we can see emerging. Just 10 days ago, there was a fascinating case whereby a group of European hackers came across a very sophisticated, very powerful software, a surveillance software, which had been developed and used by the Bavarian police in southern Germany. They stopped using it when the Constitutional Court had ruled that it was so intrusive that it was illegal. But somehow it got out of the Bavarian police cyber division, and it's now floating around there on the net for anyone with the skills to deploy it, to use. So we are now facing huge challenges in the three areas of cyber malfeasance, of cyber crime, cyber industrial espionage and cyber warfare, and we have to do something about them. This is not something you can sit back and just think doesn't happen. But perhaps the greatest challenge of all, as far as I'm concerned, is we have to do something about it without turning our societies into police states. And with that, I'll stop, and you can ask any questions. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks to Misha for his insightful comments here today. And we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. You are listening to Cybercrime with Misha Glennie. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A, and we have a standing microphone up here. If you'd like to come up and ask questions, please do. Or I could pass around the microphone. Which one would you like me to pass around, or could you come up, or... Pass around. Okay.
I'm surprised you didn't mention Barrett Lyon and his experience with and the people who, the U.S. agencies that worked with him and were thwarted by the Russian agencies. Do you know who I'm speaking of? Barrett Lyon.
Yeah.
The guy. Fatal System Error?
Sorry?
Fatal System Error.
Yeah, yeah, the guy who's written about in Fatal System Error, yeah.
Right. I'm just surprised you didn't talk about him and his experience with...
Well, that's because Joseph Menn wrote about it extensively in Fatal System Error, and so I wouldn't want to repeat what Joe has written. Uh-huh. So, you know, I mean, it's another story. I mean, the stuff about Russia is particularly interesting as far as I'm concerned. And there's one thing that I can say about that is that one of the things that emerged when I was researching Dark Market, and in particular when I was talking to people who were leading members of Carter Planet, they made it very, very plain to me about the relationship between Carter Planet members and the FSB, that's the... renamed KGB, and the SBU in Ukraine. And indeed, quite astonishingly, in 2002, Carter Planet organized the first worldwide carding conference in Odessa, where they invited a select few 400 carders from around the world who came, and they had sort of plenary sessions, and then they had sort of breakout workshops where they would discuss things like, why aren't we... scamming Diners and JCB and other minor cards more effectively, and let's diversify our portfolio, that sort of thing. And they issued a press release for the first worldwide carders conference, which I found. It took me a long time to find it, but I got it. And the first thing it says is that we wish to reiterate that any carder who attacks the financial institutions of the Russian Federation and other members of the former Soviet Union will be excluded from the community immediately and sanctions applied against them. So I said to them, I said, so what was that about? And they said, well, it was quite explicit. The deal was that as long as we attacked institutions and credit cards and banks in the United States and Western Europe, KGB said, fine, that's absolutely okay, don't worry about it. You know. But were we to attack anything in Russia, then we'd be, you know, sent to Siberia straight away. The other quid pro quo that they had to come up with was when Russia required their services for national security purposes, as, for example, in the attacks on Estonia and Georgia, that they would use their hacking, their botnet skills and all this sort of thing to assist the KGB in this work. And that is indeed... what happened. Now, the reason why all of this can happen is because Russia has the most extensive monitoring capacity of all the major states of what goes on its internet. It goes under the suitably Orwellian name of SORM-2, which means the System of Operational Investigative Mechanisms, which requires all Russian ISPs to send a mirror of every single bit that goes across their system to the FSB in Moscow. So there are these servers that the KGB are keeping, which has everything that goes on the internet in Russia. And so were you to do something bad, you would get a digital knock on the door at 4 o'clock in the morning, as it were, and they'd be saying, you know, come on, comrade, let's have a look at see what you've been writing here. And that's why it's very important, as far as I'm concerned, that we stick to the principle of judicial oversight, always, in terms of what law enforcement and the state can do in terms of getting into our computers.
Question. As a user Lambda, is there a safe website where you can find out about the do, the don'ts, the fraudulent website? Just to educate ourselves, you mentioned a couple of things where you should not click on any of those downloaded or whatever things. Is there a place where you can learn all those things?
Do you know, I don't know if there is. I mean, there are loads of websites where you can ask about how do I help myself do computer security or something. But I don't know if there's a kind of, you know, this is the one that everyone goes to, the sort of New York Times or the BBC of digital security. But I can give you a couple of tips of what to do yourself. And really, first things first is that you cannot protect yourself 100% against bad stuff on the net. In fact, if you're sensible, you start from the assumption that you have been hacked, and you start from the assumption that anything you do on the internet, someone else is looking at. So that means that, you know, one of the things that you have to do is never write in an email something that you won't be happy to see on the front page of the New York Post tomorrow morning. The other thing is that, and I have absolutely no commercial interest in this whatsoever, is go over to Apple straight away, dump your Windows, because 90% of the world's computer systems are run on Windows, and virus makers, they're not stupid. They're not going to slave over making viruses for something that nobody uses, so they're almost all for Windows, and because of that, most of the major companies which produce antivirus software for Mac give them away for free. So if you go over to Mac, not only, you know, are you reducing your risk by 90% just like that, but you can also get free protection for it. So, you know, I mean, you have to pay more for buying a Mac in the first place, but hey. So that's what you can do, and it's certainly what I do. And, of course, with the development of the iPad and the iPhones and with the popularity of Mac increasing all the time, there will be a tipping point where suddenly they say, actually, we're going to get these guys as well. But remember, if somebody wants to attack you specifically, you know, because I've been working on this subject and I deal with law enforcement, I deal with criminals and that sort of thing, and I, you know, I just know that I'm compromised. So I don't know how, I don't know who, I don't really care, but I behave in a way so that, you know, the damage is as minimal as it can possibly be.
Okay, unfortunately, we have only time for one last question. Does anyone have?
Thank you for your... It sounds like a thriller. It sounds fictional.
It is. Bye.
Anyway, what can I say? Yeah, I'm one of the people very concerned about the lack of privacy, and somebody told me that information of data about me is on Google, which I wasn't at all happy to hear. I don't know how it got there. Is there any way to get that off? And also, I've never paid for anything on the internet, but increasingly, one is forced, you know, to use the internet for everything.
Yeah.
So, would you say don't ever buy anything on the internet, and how can I get...
No, most of the stuff that you do on the internet is safe. They have increased, particularly recently, they've increased, if you're using your credit card through a secure site on the web, you're usually going to be okay. If you're unlucky and you buy something from somewhere which has poor security on its database, then you can get badly scammed. And, let's take the U.S. banking system, which has got one of the worst records of all for computer security. Now, around 2007, 2008, partly under pressure from the government, they decided they had to beef up their external security, and they've done that. And Citibank is reckoned to have one of the top security systems of all US banks. And yet, a couple of months ago, Citibank lost 200,000 account details, people and their account numbers. Now, if that's the best that the US banking system can come up with, then there really remains cause for concern. Now, one of the things that's happened in the United Kingdom is that HSBC has introduced a system whereby if you don't, they tell you when you start computer banking with them, they say you have to download our authentication software, which is called Rapport. And if you don't download it and install it and your account is compromised, we will not compensate you. Now, that is a good thing because it makes people focus on the responsibility that they have when it comes to cybersecurity. But I wish to see that extended to the banks themselves. I mean this very seriously. I wish to see executives and directors be held responsible if you have a breach the size of the one that happened to Citibank two or three months ago, that the directors and the executives will be penalized, just as we're penalized if we don't install the rapport on the HSBC stuff, for failing to protect their customers' data. But offline web, it's really hard to get stuff off the web once it's out there, because it doesn't, in one sense, it doesn't just belong to Google. It belongs to anyone else who happens to have looked at it, downloaded it, and stored it. And so you've basically got two choices. You accept the fact that a lot of your life is exposed and vulnerable. You keep it down to a minimum where possible, or you can try the really brave thing to do, which is to go offline. And it's getting very close to impossible to live your life offline. But get this, and I'll finish up with this, which really, really makes me very, very angry. Gilsey, the guy from Sri Lanka there, where after his trial in the United Kingdom, now I can be nasty about Tony Blair, one of the raft of criminal legislation that Tony Blair brought in an attempt to be a populist as Prime Minister was the so-called Prevention of Crime Order. And they have fixed penalties for preventing crime if you've been convicted of a crime in the United Kingdom. Gilsey, as a computer criminal, was told that after his release from prison next year, that for 5 years he will not be allowed to access the internet except for 1 hour a week under police supervision in a public place. Now, we're getting to a stage where you can't brush your teeth without a bloody computer connected to the internet. And so to do that to Gilsey, whose only skill is using computers, you're saying to him, you will not work. You will not participate in society. And, of course, because of the proliferation of handheld devices, which aren't telephones, they're computers, this is just crazy, because Gilsey will be forced to go underground because the very act of using a phone will be illegal as far as he's concerned. And so this is why we've got to start thinking in new ways which are not appropriate and old-style criminal justice system. This type of crime requires a new criminal justice system, and we haven't even begun to think about that. Thank you.
Well, thanks to Misha for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.